I'm Professor Eric E. Johnson, welcoming you to the Sales Lightning Review, taped in front of a live classroom audience at the University of North Dakota School of Law. We applaud because that's how we prove we're in front of a live classroom audience. Here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to refresh your recollection about as much sales law doctrine as I can in a very short amount of time. I'm going to go very fast to make that happen. I'm particularly hopeful that this will be useful to students who've taken contracts already or sales already to help them interrupt the forgetting process. If you don't come back to course content you have learned, it will eventually evaporate from your brain. If you come back to it periodically, you'll be able to retain it for longer. So that's the idea here. And I also hope this will be useful for studying for the bar exam, although obviously this is not a substitute for a bar prep program. If you want more on sales law, there are handouts, slideshows, problems with answers, an open source casebook, and old exams on my website at ericejohnson.com. So let's start with some general observations and concerns, and pay attention during this part because these general principles and things can help you reason your way through a lot of the details that come up later. Here's some big overarching principles. First of all, this is my slogan in teaching sales, is that the UCC wants deals to happen. UCC is the Uniform Commercial Code. It wants deals to happen. It's like, commercial is my middle name, literally. UCC wants deals to happen, and that explains a lot of the rules we see. The UCC cares very much about freedom of contract, letting the parties decide the rules and the terms for themselves. But the UCC thinks that setting out a bunch of default rules that are sensible will help people make more deals and make those deals faster. Also, the UCC thinks that merchants are special and that merchants have their big kid pants on and they can take care of themselves better than ordinary buyers and sellers. Merchants come up several times, so let's talk about who counts as a merchant. The UCC says that you're a merchant if you deal in goods of the kind or otherwise by your occupation hold yourself out as having knowledge or skill peculiar to the practices or goods involved in the transaction or to whom that knowledge or skill would be attributed by your employment. So in other words, if you buy a set of tires from the tire store on the corner, that's a merchant. If you buy a set of tires at a garage sale, the person holding the garage sale is not a merchant. You wouldn't expect the person at the garage sale to know anything about tires. So about the UCC and its sales law. UCC stands for the Uniform Commercial Code. It was created by two organizations cooperating, the Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute. It derives its legal authority from being enacted by the legislature in a given jurisdiction. It doesn't have any authority by itself. It's got to be enacted into law. Article 1 of the UCC is definitions and generally applicable provisions. Article 2 is sales of goods. Then there's other articles you can attack on secured transactions or banking or other exciting things, leases. Article 2 on sales of goods has been adopted in 49 states, not Louisiana. And in the District of Columbia and various territories and tribal jurisdictions, there are many variations among its provisions as it's been enacted. So, ironically, it's not actually uniform, even though that's its first name. It is statute, not common law. So if you have questions about the meaning of words or what the law requires, your first stop is to look at the statutory text. It is often answered right in there instead of using logic or policy rationales or analogies to cases. That includes Article 1, where the definitions are. So if you're doing sales of goods, you need to look at Article 1 for those definitions. The UCC is supplemented by the common law and by equitable principles, so if something's not covered by the statute, then you can think about common law and equity. That's where fraud, for instance, comes into transactions about sales of goods. And, again, the UCC cares about freedom of contract, so many of its provisions can be altered by agreement, although there's some things that you can't contract around, such as fraud, such as the statute of frauds. That'd be silly. Well, it's not in writing because we agreed that it didn't have to be in writing. That wouldn't make any sense. So there's some things you can't contract around. So should you apply UCC Article 2 to the transaction in front of you? That's the first question we have to tackle. The UCC Article 2 applies to sales of goods. What are goods? Goods are things that are movable at the time they are identified to the contract. Generally, it includes things that you don't normally think of as goods, like food served in a restaurant, maybe industrial gases, big and small, wide-body aircraft, pencils, iron ore. That's all goods. It does not include services, real property, land, houses. It does not include stocks and bonds and securities. It does not include leases. That's actually covered in Article 2A of the UCC. A lot of contracts involve both goods and services. You contract to have some machine installed in your factory, and they're going to deliver it. You're going to get the machine. They're going to deliver it. They're going to install it. They're going to teach you how to use it. It's a mixture of goods and services. You have to pick, if you're a court and you have a dispute about this, you have to pick either the UCC or the common law of contracts to govern that transaction. So how do you do that? You apply one of two tests. The first test, which almost all courts apply, is the predominant purpose test. That you look at the time of contracting, what was the predominant purpose of the contract? What were they really after? Were they really after the good or the services? You have to make a determination. There's also a gravamen test, which is not used by a lot of courts, but it looks at the dispute. It looks at the gripe that the party has. That's the gravamen test. So you do that, and then you decide whether or not you're dealing with the UCC. If you're not dealing with the UCC, then you know you can stop and go to the common law of contracts, because that's not what I'm talking about right now. All right. Let's talk about the hierarchy of rules to apply to a dispute about a contract over the sale of goods. You start with the terms of the agreement itself. The UCC believes in freedom of contract. You're allowed to alter the deal, including dispute resolution. So you look first at the express terms of the contract, although there are some things you can't contract around, but that's the first place to look. After that, you look at the provisions of the UCC. And then if it's not answered in there, you can look to the common law or equitable principles. The UCC does not displace those entirely. Next big topic, we'll talk about formation of the contract, offer and acceptance and all that stuff. Some initial observations. Don't get freaked out by the battle of the forms, the great hard subject. You hear that, you shut down. Don't do that. Okay? We'll get there, but it's, you know, relax. A lot of it's more intuitive than you think. Contract formation of the UCC is largely logical and obeys broad principles that are easy to learn. There's some strange stuff, but it's actually pretty limited, like 22072. We'll get there. But here's a key thing at the outset. You don't want to jump to employing this strange stuff if you don't have to. So don't go there unless it's really called for. Think through the broad principles and the normal stuff first. Don't lose your head. Now, there's lots of ways to teach and learn formation under the UCC, such as by concentrating on the text of the statutory provisions, 2204 to 2207. That's probably the best way. We're not going to do that because audio. So I'm going to do this mostly principles-based and try to concentrate on the logic of it. So here's broad principles, key points for formation. Remember, first, the UCC wants deals to happen. Next, the UCC sees a distinction between what sales executives and business people do, which is make deals, and what lawyers do, which is, at least according to the UCC, focus on legalese. So who do you think the UCC cares more about? The deal makers, because the UCC wants deals to happen. So the UCC almost has this attitude of, ew, yucky lawyers, even though it was written by lawyers. The UCC thinks deals can and should happen when the business people want to have a deal and when they think they have a deal, even if the lawyers would see differences. But the UCC also cares about freedom of contract. So if the deal makers want the legalese to matter, they can make it matter. Now, key thing to remember here is, this will help you with a lot of these formation problems, is that the UCC got rid of the common law's mirror image rule. Under the common law mirror image rule, you need the offer and the acceptance to be the exact same thing so that we have a meeting of the minds and we have a contract. The UCC got rid of that. Why? Because the UCC wants deals to happen. So it got rid of that so that more deals can happen. An effect of the common law mirror image rule is what people call the last shot rule, but it's probably better called the last shot effect, which is that if you're going to demand a mirror image between offer and acceptance, the last version of the contract that flies out there is a proposal, and then you have conduct, the courts are going to see that conduct is accepting the last version out there. So that's the last shot rule or last shot effect, and the UCC rejects that. So here's how the UCC imagines things. There's some company makes instrument panels for huge machines with lots of dials and gauges on them and big red buttons and yellow painted huge surfaces. And someone gets on the phone and says, "Can you send us three more X7000 instrument panels?" "You bet. Deal. Hang up the phone. All right. That, the UCC loves something like that. This is a deal, and it's enforceable. The UCC is all over that because the UCC wants deals to happen. Common law of contracts would be freaking out. But the UCC is like, that's great. That's a deal. That's enforceable. We can do that. And the UCC will fill in the gaps and fill things in with defaults to make that an enforceable deal. So here's some ways that deals can happen. You can have one document that's signed by both parties. That's neat. That's tidy. That's a contract. And the terms are what's in the document. You can have a deal where there's two documents, offer and acceptance, and the terms match. That's great. That's a contract, and those are the terms. You can have an agreement reached orally, on the phone, or in person, and there are no writings. That's great. That's a deal. That's a contract, and those are the terms. You can have a written offer for purchase that is sent to a seller, and it's accepted by shipment of the goods. That's a contract, and the terms are the ones that are in the offer. Easy. Any written offer that's sent, if it's accepted by conduct, that's a contract, and the terms are the ones in the offer. Easy. Lots of easy situations here in formation that are completely logical. We don't need to lose our head, go off to some kind of battle of the forms. This is how most of the stuff probably works in the real world. Okay, here's something. There's a written offer for purchase that's sent off to a seller. An order acknowledgement is sent back by the seller to the buyer, but it has some differences in the writing from the offer. Now we have something that requires some more thought. So in the imagining of the UCC and also in the real world, although less these days than back in a few decades ago when the UCC was put together, a lot of sales transactions would work like this. You'd have a document generated by the buyer that's a purchase order. And then it would be sent off to the seller, and the seller would generate a document called an order acknowledgement. And in lawyer words, the purchase order is the offer, and the order acknowledgement is the acceptance. Within these documents, the purchase order and the order acknowledgement, and if you've ever had a temp office job, especially if it was a few decades ago, you've probably seen a lot of these things. They kind of exist in two chunks. There's a top, easy to read part that talks about price and the item and the quantity. Those are what are called the dickered terms, when salespeople and buyers dicker back and forth and they reach a bargain. Those are the terms they care about. That's how they fill out the form. Then there's a bunch of boilerplate on the bottom that's the boring legalese that no one wants to read, the quote unquote fine print. Now, most of law, we say, well, fine print, Dickered terms, it's all the same. It's all law. But the UCC says, no, fine print's kind of stupid, so we're going to treat it differently. So you have to understand that to understand how the UCC goes to where it goes with this kind of weird stuff. So we have a purchase order or an offer that's been sent. It says one set of things, and then we have an acceptance, purported acceptance that comes back in order acknowledgement. It has some different things. First, we have to determine whether or not The order acknowledgement counts as an acceptance. If we're going to have a contract, we have to have acceptance. So we ask, this is the language from the statute, is it a definite and seasonable expression of acceptance? Definite and seasonable expression of acceptance. If it doesn't count as a definite and seasonable expression of acceptance, then we don't have a contract. If it does, then it's a contract. Then we're going to have to figure out what the terms are, but we know that at least we have a contract. Okay, so let's talk about this. How can we determine whether or not this acceptance that comes back counts as a definite and seasonable expression of acceptance? It can still be an acceptance if the writings differ. We know that. That's the whole premise of this. But it's got to be close enough that it counts as an acceptance. So here's one way to think about it. It's not really an official test, but do the executives think they have a deal? Do the people without law degrees who are on the phone making the deals, do they think they have a deal? If they think they have a deal, then they probably have a deal, even if the lawyers be saying, well, there's important differences here in the fine print. So if the executives think they have a deal, then you know, as a rough approximation, then that's probably an acceptance. Okay, here's just some hypotheticals. Let's say the purchase order and the order acknowledgement have a different price. The purchase order is for 3X7000 units at $10,000 each, and the order acknowledgement is, thank you, we'll fill that order for $50,000 each. There's no contract, okay? There's no deal there, all right? That's not a definite and seasonable. That's something the executives would think, oh, we don't have a deal. We're far apart on price. How about it's a different item? The purchase order is for an X7000, and the order acknowledgement is, we agree to fill your order for a Y17. That's no deal on that. Now, what if there's different wording on the remedies limitations? Okay, yeah, that's fine. That's still a deal. The sales executives didn't even read that stuff. We can still have a deal with that. Okay, how about the order acknowledgement adds some provision about how to send warranty notices? Yeah, that's fine. UCC wants deals to happen. That's fine. Well, we can have a deal with something like that. Okay, so now, and where's the dividing line in between? I don't know. Go ask your mom or dad. We can have a big debate over, and you can look at a lot of cases and whatever. But the dividing line's somewhere in there. So we know that there's at least situations that will fall into those two different camps. Now, if we have different or additional terms in the offer and the acceptance, then we got to ask. Okay, we know we have a contract, but what are the terms of the contract? We're going to have to figure that out. It depends under the UCC whether we have different terms or whether the acceptance has additional terms. And you could have a great philosophical battle about this, but we're not going to do that because it's the sales lightning review, and we're going to keep going. We're not going to have philosophical discussions about it. But let's assume there's a difference between different or additional terms. If they are different, then the different terms knock each other out. And the terms are instead filled by the UCC with course of performance, course of dealing, usage of trade, UCC gap fillers, etc. So the offer has a choice of venue of the courts in Los Angeles County, and the acceptance has choice of venue of the courts in San Francisco. We'll fill it up with whatever the UCC will prescribe, and those things will knock each other out. This knockout rule is not actually in the UCC because they didn't think to put it in there, but it was created by courts in trying to figure out how to deal with the UCC, and the majority of courts follow this knockout rule, and it seems sensible. Okay, if the acceptance has an additional term, something thrown in there that wasn't spoken to in the offer, then the additional terms are considered proposals for adding to the deal. Okay, all right, it's a proposal, and it's just laying out there. Now, if the deal is not between merchants, then it just stays a proposal, unless someone agrees to it. Oh, you know, I was looking through the fine print, and I saw you had this weird arbitration provision or choice venue, and I want you to know I agree to that. Oh, okay, well, then now you have an acceptance on that. Otherwise, it's just going to hang out there as a proposal. Now, if the deal is between merchants, there's merchants on both sides offering acceptance, then the UCC 2207 has these funny rules about automatically making those additional terms part of the deal, unless some things happen. And this is where we get into some strange stuff. But you can see how far we are down here, that this is not all the deals. This is just comes up in this particular situation. We have additional terms where the offer and acceptance differ. We have still a contract. They're close enough, we have a contract, but there's this additional term. So if it's between merchants on both sides, then the additional terms are automatically added unless they materially alter the deal. So a lot of ink has been spilled on what that might be, but you know, you can just take a guess before you go into the case research. Or an objection is made within a reasonable time. Well, I know you're a merchant, I'm a merchant, and so I was reading this fine print because I know about 22072, and I don't agree to this choice of venue thing you stuck in here. Okay. Or the offer is expressly limits acceptance to its terms. So if you send a purchase order that says, this purchase order is expressly limited to you agreeing to all these fine print terms and not adding anything, oh, then you can do that. I mean, if you want to be real particular about it, you can do that. In that case, an acceptance with anything different isn't going to add those terms. Now, what if both the purchase order and the order acknowledgement both say they are expressly conditioned on agreement to all the fine print terms and conditions? So they're both claiming this only counts if you agree to everything in here. Just take a second to think about that. Well, this is easy. Then there's no contract on the writings. Obviously, those writings can't establish a contract because they just said that they couldn't. Okay. So a contract might end up getting established by conduct. If the goods get shipped and the money changes hands, then we must have a contract. But it's not established by the writings. Okay, let's ask a different question. What if the purchase order and the order acknowledgement are contradictory in terms of the Dickard terms, in terms of what the sales executives and the buyer executives care about? So one's ordering Y7000 and the other one's ordering an X1950. All right? In that case, again, the writings don't establish a contract. Obviously, they can't because they're too far apart. Now, a contract might end up getting established by conduct. We'll see, but the writings aren't establishing that. You know, it's the same answer to either of those things. If the writings aren't going to establish a contract, then we don't have a contract. So then, okay, now we have to figure out what are the terms if the writings don't establish a contract. And there's actually a very logical answer to that, and that's in 22073, and it says that the contract consists of all the terms of the writings on which the parties agree. So everywhere that the offer and the acceptance are the same, that's part of the contract. And everywhere where they're different, then we'll fill it up with the supplementary terms, course of performance, course of dealing, usage of trade, gap fillers. Make sense? That's really essentially a knockout rule, except that one's actually written in the statute. So that was it. That was Battle of the Forms. We did Battle of the Forms. See, it was less painful than you thought. I kind of snuck it up on you. That's the Battle of the Forms. Most of it's logical. There's that one part that's kind of weird about the additional terms, but most of it's pretty reasonable and not entirely counterintuitive. Okay, so we did Battle of the Forms. Let's move on to something else. Let's talk about firm offers. A firm offer is an offer that can't be revoked. Ordinarily, you make an offer for a contract, you can say, oh, I changed my mind, I revoke, if it hasn't already been accepted. Under the common law, there's no way to make firm offers unless you have consideration. But under the UCC, you can do that. So under the UCC, there's two ways that a firm offer can be binding and that you can't take it back as the offeror. First is if there's independent consideration. That's the same as the common law. So if I agree to hold, if I say I will let you purchase up to 10 jumbo jet engines for $1.2 million a piece, I'm going to hold it open for 6 months. And in return for that, you're going to pay me $100,000. That's what we could call an option contract. That's a whole contract to have the option to buy something. That's exchanging money for a promise. Okay, but under the UCC, which is special and different from the common law, you can have a binding firm offer without consideration if it's from a merchant again, UCC says merchants can bind themselves to some things because they got the big kid pants on that we wouldn't want other people doing, but merchants should know what they're doing. So if it comes from a merchant and it's in a signed writing, seems pretty reasonable. We want that assurance, okay? And obviously, it's got to say that it will be held open. So it's got to come from a merchant, be in a signed writing, and say that it's irrevocable or that it's firm or that it'll be held open. Then it can't be revoked, and it will be held open and enforceable for 3 months. But without independent consideration, it's not irrevocable beyond 3 months. Even if it says it'll be held open for 6 months, you can only enforce it without consideration up to 3 months. All right, that's firm offers. Let's talk about the statute of frauds. Statute of frauds is a common law doctrine, even though it says statute. UCC took the common law doctrine, called statute, and actually turned it into a statute, which is kind of nice, which is where it probably wanted to be all along. So the UCC has its statute of frauds, and it says that when the price of a good is $500 or more, the contract must be evidenced by a signed writing. There's some exceptions. We'll get to that in a second. So what counts as a signed writing, $500 or more? This is very important. The signed writing doesn't have to be the contract. You don't have to have the whole contract written down. You just need a signed writing, and the writing has to evidence the contract. Mostly, it just needs to specify the quantity of goods, and it has to be signed by the party against whom enforcement is sought. Now, the requirements for signed under the UCC are very liberal. You send off an email that's got the little thing at the bottom, the email signature that says your name and where you work for and your Facebook, link to your Facebook. That counts as a signature under the UCC. Putting an X on the bottom of a document, like all cartoon characters always sign all documents with an X. That actually counts as a signature under the UCC. Sending something on letterhead, even without signing it, counts as being signed. It shows that you mean it. That you mean it coming from you. You're authenticating it, in other words. Okay, let's talk about the exception. So, statute of frauds, $500 or more, we need a signed writing. Except, there's sometimes you can have an enforceable contract even without the signed writing for something $500 or more. Here's your exceptions. Payment was made and accepted. Okay, then I'm not so worried about misunderstanding or fraud there. The goods were received and accepted. Okay, payment made and accepted, goods received and accepted are exceptions. If they are specially manufactured goods where there's a reliance interest. So I thought you were going to buy these. I specially made them. No one else wants this mauve-colored 30-foot curtain. Then that's an exception to the statute of frauds. Admission in court testimony or pleading. We figure that that's worth an exception. Promissory estoppel and outright fraud. Many courts have interpreted that to be exceptions. And then there's a between merchants exception. So here, exciting, we have another thing special for merchants. So let's explain what this between merchants exception means. Even where the party against whom enforcement is sought never created a signed writing, the statute of frauds can be satisfied with a written confirmation that was sent to them, even though they never signed it, under specified circumstances. So first, both parties have to be merchants. So as a mere consumer, you can't get blindsided by receiving a confirmation you never read for something for $10,000 that you never... So it's got to be between merchants. Next, the writing has to be sufficient against the sender. What does that mean? That means if I'm going to send you, we made an oral deal for something $500 or over, and then I send you a written confirmation. If I'm going to try to hold you to the deal, my written confirmation has to have been sufficient to bind me. That'd be pretty raw. If I could send you something that's a written confirmation and I could weasel out of it, but you couldn't. So that's pretty sensible. The writing has to be sufficient against the sender. The sender's bound her or himself. Then the recipient has to have reason to know of the contents of the confirmation. Note, they don't actually have to read it. So some merchant who's really behind on their email and the subject line says, confirming our agreement, but they're like just not getting around to reading it. And then they get around to reading it 2 weeks later and like, oh, that's not what I agreed to at all. Whoops. You got to read your email if you're a merchant. So if you have, so if both parties are merchants, the written confirmation is sufficient against the sender. The recipient has reason to know of its contents, and the recipient fails to object within 10 days, then they're bound. So read your email at least every 10 days, please, if you are a merchant and you've given any other merchant your email address. That's formation then. We talked about the battle of the forms. We talked about firm offers. We talked about statute of frauds. Let's talk. Move on to another big area here and talk about the terms of the contract. What are the terms of the contract? Remember, the UCC wants deals to happen, so the deals might happen so fast that we're going to have to spend some time later on figuring out what the terms were. That's okay. The UCC wants to see that commerce happen, and we can work on the terms on the back end, and that's what we're going to see here. So there's a hierarchy for determining what the content of a contract is. And here it is from highest to lowest. Got first the express terms. If it's express, that's first. After that, course of performance, then course of dealing, then usage of trade. Now, this only makes logical sense. You really don't have to memorize this because it really has to be this way. Express terms are what we expressly agreed on. That's got to come first. After that is course of performance. How have we performed in this transaction? If this transaction has taken 2 years to play out, and for the first 18 months you've always been paying for delivery and never charged me for shipping, that says a lot about whether or not shipping is your responsibility. Next is course of dealing. So not this contract, but our other dealings, the same buyer and seller over our history. Have you always been paying for shipping? That's the next place we're going to go. And then finally, usage of trade, all the buyers and all the sellers in this sector. Okay, so it really has to be that way. You don't really have to memorize that. It's got to be express terms, then course of performance of this contract, then course of dealing of all our contracts between buyer and seller, then usage of trade, all the contracts of all the buyers and sellers. Okay. Then, after all that, then we get the UCC gap fillers. So note that we don't go to the UCC gap fillers unless the other higher rungs on the hierarchy don't tell us the answer. So we're not going to go to the UCC, what's the gap filler for who's responsible for shipping or delivery. We're not going to go to that unless we don't have an answer from the express terms of the contract, course of performance, course of dealing, or usage of trade. And still, this just makes logical sense. The UCC figures that the parties themselves and the trade are going to know better than all the people in the ULC and ALI meeting in some meeting someplace several decades ago about how you want to do your deal. So the UCC gap fillers have to come last. All right. What's the principle that explains all this? The UCC cares about freedom of contract. The UCC would rather the you people, the buyers and the sellers, or at least all the buyers and all the sellers in the trade make up the terms of the contract before they do. They care about freedom of contract. Okay. So remember we had our hypothetical deal on the instrument gauges. Can you send us three more X7000 instrument panels? You bet. Deal. Hang on. All right. That, which the UCC loves, commerce happening because the UCC wants deals to happen. What are the terms? The gap fillers come in and can fill all those terms for us. All right. So really, if you notice, The two key things that we know from this deal is we know what the good was. It was the X7000 instrument panel. And we know how many there were. There were three. So quantity and the item are things that we can't really fill the gap for. But other things we can fill the gap for, such as price. Well, we didn't say what the price is. Well, the UCC will fill the gap. The price is a reasonable price. That was really clever. You came up with that all by yourself, a reasonable price. Yeah, reasonable price. Okay, and how will we figure that out? Well, we can look at the seller's catalog, or we can look at the market price, or what have they paid in the past. Delivery. Okay, delivery, the gap filler, is the seller's place of business. You know that from just going around in the world. You buy something. Unless you pay for shipping, you're going to have to go pick it up. You kind of already know that. Okay. Time. Oh, here's one they came up with. Time, how fast things have to happen. A reasonable time. Wow, thank you, UCC, for that. How much do we pay for per hour for you to come up with reasonable time? So we've got reasonable price, reasonable time, and delivery at the seller's place of business, and then payment due on tender of delivery. Pretty easy. So those are some of the gap fillers, if you're wondering what those are. And we have the gap fillers because the UCC wants deals to happen. Commerce is my middle name. Let's make those deals happen. All right. Relax. We're going to now talk about something that people get a little, you know, get some of the muscles tensed up about, but it's not going to be that hard. We're going to talk about the parole evidence rule. All right? I'm going to take you through it. We're going to talk about it at the same time as we talk about contract interpretation, because we really got to talk about them together. It doesn't make sense to talk about them apart. So let's talk about contract interpretation and the parole evidence rule. Contract interpretation, let's start with that. Contract interpretation is a question of law. You know, that means that it's up to the judge, not the jury. The judge is going to decide this. The interpretation of an unambiguous contract is a question of law. Whether a contract is ambiguous is a question of law. The judge is going to determine that. Now, what's an ambiguity in a contract? Contractual language is ambiguous if it is susceptible to two or more reasonable interpretations. If it is, it's ambiguous. That's all it takes to be ambiguous, and then it's ambiguous. Now, if contractual language is ambiguous, and the judge is going to decide that, then the court will admit extrinsic evidence, evidence from outside the contract, from beyond the four corners, to determine which interpretation the parties intended. This determination is a fact issue and can be tried by a jury, because now we're trying to think about intent. Intent is one of those questions. Who knows what you were really intending? You, God, and a jury of 12 people that couldn't get out of jury service. That's who can determine what you were thinking, what you were intending. Okay. The overarching principle of contract interpretation is to give effect to the party's intentions. Some main ideas here: objectively expressed intent controls over subjectively understood intent. What you could tell from the outside by looking at the deal is more important than what someone was secretly thinking. It's really got to be that way. A contract is to be construed in its entirety. Each part is considered in relation to every other part. And language is to be interpreted according to its plain, ordinary, generally accepted meaning, unless both parties intended for it to mean something else, like it's some industry jargon. For instance, a 2x4 is not 2 inches by 4 inches, which drives some people crazy. But that's, everyone knows that a 2x4 is less I don't want to guess wrong. I think it's 1.5 by 3.5 inches. Whatever. Look it up. But that's an example of industry jargon. All right. Now that we've talked about contract interpretation, now we can get to the parole evidence rule. The parole evidence rule is a substantive doctrine of contract law. It is not a rule of evidence. And of course, it also has nothing to do with prisoners being out on parole. But the word root does come from the Old French for both parole evidence and prisoners on parole. The French root for promise and word, and it's related to the Latin for speech. So they share that. Okay. Here's the parole evidence rule, black letter statement. Part one, with a partially integrated contract, no evidence of any prior or contemporaneous oral agreement may be used to contradict the written terms of the contract. Partially integrated contract, no evidence of any prior contemporaneous oral agreement may be used to contradict the written terms of the contract. With a fully integrated contract, no evidence of any prior or contemporaneous oral agreement may be used to contradict or add to the written terms of the contract. If you think about it, those two rules for partially integrated and fully integrated are really the same thing, which is that the parole evidence rule is saying that to the extent the contract said, I meant to specify this, then you can't contradict that. So a fully integrated contract, You can't add to or you can't vary or add to it because a fully integrated contract is saying, I have everything in here. So to add to a fully integrated contract would be to vary its terms, in essence. So what it means is, to the extent a contract's integrated, you can't mess with that. How do you know if a contract is integrated? We have the integration clause, also called a merger clause. If you want to make your contract fully integrated, then put in a merger clause. The merger clause says that the writing represents the entire agreement between the parties. That will usually work to make a contract integrated. Now, can you introduce extrinsic evidence to help interpret a fully integrated written contract? Of course you can. The parole evidence rule doesn't say that you can't. The parole evidence rule does not bar the introduction of extrinsic evidence for contract interpretation. Even in an integrated agreement, if it's ambiguous, we're going to need extrinsic evidence to determine what the parties meant by what they said. So long as the evidence isn't used to contradict the words of the agreement or fully integrated to add to its terms. If we are interpreting, we can use extrinsic evidence. So extrinsic evidence, however, of course, can't be used to prove an interpretation that, based on the language, isn't reasonable. Makes sense. Okay, let's just ask some questions. You can answer these in, you know, the silence of your own mind. Can you introduce extrinsic evidence for the interpretation of a written contract? Yes, you can. Because, well, number one, it's a free country. Yeah, and the parole evidence rule doesn't say that you can't. Can you introduce extrinsic evidence for the interpretation of a fully integrated written contract? Uh-huh, free country. I can do it if I want to. Parole evidence rule doesn't say that I can't. Can you introduce extrinsic evidence to add to or vary the terms of a written contract? Yeah, unless you're going to tell me it's integrated. If that's all I know about it, then sure. Can you introduce extrinsic evidence to add to or vary the terms of a fully integrated written contract? No, you can't. Now, finally, we've got something you can't do, because that's the parole evidence rule. That's exactly what the parole evidence rule says, that you can't do. So that's the parole evidence rule. It's no bigger or smaller than that. Just remember, it is what it is, and don't jump to trying to employ it when you are just interpreting an ambiguous provision of a contract. Let's move on to our next big area. Very exciting, and talk about warranties. So here's some important general observations about warranties. Keep these in mind. They'll keep you from going off in the wrong direction when you're talking about warranties. This first one's important, because a lot of people intuitively, this doesn't seem right. But warranty liability does not depend on fault. You can be super innocent and be liable under a warranty. It doesn't depend on fault at all. If your product, if you sell a car, and when it drives away, the wheels come off, that's a breach of warranty for sure. What if it was some ne'er-do-well spy who came in and took all the lug nuts off of the wheels? It doesn't matter. I know it's not your fault, but that's a breach of warranty. Warranty liability can happen also without any contract between the plaintiff and the defendant. How can you have contractual liability when a party's not a party to the contract? Yeah, see, warranty liability is not quite contractual liability. It's a little bit magical that way. Warranty liability has some features of tort liability. It has some features of contractual liability, and it has some dissimilarities with both. And at least as far as I'm concerned, I think it's best to think of breach of warranty as its own kind of action. Neither tort nor breach of contract, breach of warranty is its own thing. If you just conceptualize it that way, it will help you avoid some problems. Here's some kinds of warranties. We'll run through these. Warranty of title, warranty against infringement, implied warranty of merchantability, implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, and express warranties. Let's talk first about warranty of title. This is the most important thing probably in the entire UCC Article 2. If I buy something, I want to own it afterwards. It'd be pretty surprising if I didn't. That's what the warranty of title is all about. So the warranty of title arises in every contract unless excluded, disclaimed, or modified. It warrants that title conveyed is good, transfer is rightful, and that it's free of any security interest or other lien, except what is actually known to the buyer and should have known doesn't count. You can see the UCC is pretty tough here on warranty of title because that's sort of the whole idea of a sale, that I end up owning it after I bought it. Now, note that for an effective disclaimer, if you have an effective disclaimer of the implied warranties, we'll talk about what counts as an effective disclaimer of implied warranties later, but an effective disclaimer of implied warranties does not count as an effective disclaimer of the warranty of title. It's not considered an implied warranty that way. If you want to disclaim the warranty of title, if you want to sell something to someone that you don't necessarily own, then you need specific language or very, very particular circumstances that would put a buyer on warning, such as selling unclaimed property at a police auction. Then, you know, I get it. I might not have good title. Next, the warranty against infringement. This arises on goods sold by merchant sellers. This is one that applies to merchants who are regularly dealing in goods of the kind, unless excluded, disclaimed, or modified. It warrants that the good can be possessed and used normally without a rightful claim of infringement by a third-party holder of some intellectual property rights. You sell me a printer, I should be able to use it without getting sued for patent infringement by someone out there. That's the warranty against infringement, at least if I buy a printer from the office store. If I buy a printer at a garage sale, that's not a merchant, so I'm not going to be able to come after them for the warranty against infringement. This, in terms of disclaiming, this is the same as the warranty of title. An effective disclaimer of the implied warranties does not disclaim the implied warranty. Does not disclaim the warranty against infringement. You need specific language or very particular circumstances. Let's come to one of the big ones. This is probably the biggest one. This is like boardwalk on the monopoly board of warranties, the implied warranty of merchantability. It arises, thanks to its name, merchantability, you could probably guess this, where the seller is a merchant of goods of the kind, unless it's excluded, disclaimed, or modified, and it warrants that the goods are merchantable. I mean, I talk about what merchantable means in a second here. If you want to disclaim the implied warranty of merchantability, then you have two alternatives. You can either mention the word merchantability and be conspicuous, or you can use a phrase like as is or with all faults that everyone understands to mean that there's no implied warranty of merchantability. So either mention merchantability and be conspicuous, or use as is or with all faults or similar language. Okay, what does merchantable mean? When something is warranted to be merchantable, what does that mean? It means that it is fit for the ordinary purposes for such goods. So if I buy a car, I should be able to drive it. It warrants that it is adequately contained, packaged, labeled. If I order eggs, they should not come in loose in a Ziploc bag. Merchantable means that they would pass without objection in the trade under the contract description, that they will run within quality and quantity standards of usage for trade in the contract description, that they will conform to the promises and affirmations of fact on the container or label, and much more. Note that the implied warranty of merchantability applies to used goods as well as new goods, but a merchantable used car is different than a merchantable new car. Let's take a break and come back with the exciting part 2.